Hey, if you love The Bachelor, which is an embattled franchise lately, but still, people still love it. We have, I think, the best Bachelor podcast. It is called Bachelor Party, hosted by Julia Lippmann. It's been a staple of the Ringer Podcast Network since 2016. She returned this week. She broke down the season premiere with Nora Princiati, and Julia will be on that feed twice a week. Subscribe now on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also brought to you by TheRinger.com as well as The Ringer Podcast Network. I put up a new Rewatchables with Sean Fennessy and Chris Ryan on Monday night. We did the 40th anniversary of Raiders of the Lost Ark, only one of the greatest movies of all time. We have another podcast premiering on my Book of Basketball 2.0 feed. It is called What If, the Len Bias Story. It's done by The Ringer's Jordan Kahn. I was not involved in this podcast other than a little behind the scenes stuff, but we're doing this as another season of Book of Basketball, 7 parts. It just goes into everything. It's one of the most shocking deaths in the history of sports. It changed the trajectory of the 80s in the NBA. It changed the trajectory of the Celtics. It became a turning point for the cocaine panic in America. There's a lot of unanswered questions about it that we dive into. And I think this podcast is really, really good. It premieres on June 9th, which is this week. And it will be on the Book of Basketball 2.0 feed. I hope you're subscribing to that already. But if for some reason you're not, check it out. And those pods will be up once a week the next 7 weeks. So usually I've been starting with the NBA at the top of these pods. But it's a slight lull here. I thought maybe we could get away with just putting up a me and Chuck pod without knowing anything that happened tonight in the basketball games. Right now I'm taping this. It is 4:30 Pacific time. Hawks, Sixers game 2. It's just about to start. Clippers, Jazz, game 1 is about to start. If there was ever a day to maybe just say, screw it, we'll cover all this stuff on Thursday, I think today's today, because Chuck and I have to catch up. A lot of stuff to talk about. A lot of stuff. Brooklyn Nets, Trae Young, UFOs, music documentaries, all kinds of things. So if we come out of Pearl Jam and I'm talking and I'm telling you that it's 9 o'clock at night or whatever, and this crazy thing happened, that meant something genuinely crazy happened in basketball. If not, we'll cover basketball on Thursday's pod. Bringing in Chuck right now. First, Pearl Jam. All right, Chuck Klosterman is here. We're taping this on a Tuesday afternoon. There's a lot going on. I have to ask you this, though. We should start here. You have the local perspective on the franchise superstar who nobody knows if he's going to leave or not. You live in Portland. You've been there a couple years. Everyone there loves Dame Lillard. And now it seems like he's staying. They have to get a new coach. Seems like he has more power, but in this day of the super team and stars aligning, you just never know when your star is going to leave. What is the mood in Portland with the Dame situation?
Well, okay. My analysis of the mood in Portland is what a guy working on my downstairs bathroom, a contractor, told me this morning, since I don't really go out into Portland that much. But we talked about Lillard this morning a little bit. There's all these assumptions about him. There is an assumption that he is sort of inherently loyal and that he will do whatever he can to stay in Portland, seemingly based on the fact that he's from Oakland. I don't fully understand. I mean, in some ways, the relationship makes sense to me, but in other ways, it does not. The thing is, though, that if he starts in any way to express a desire to leave, trade him as soon as you can, because that's just how it is now. I mean, the Harden thing, I think, really is a hinge point in this. This has been happening for a while, but, you know, you can see this a little bit with Aaron Rodgers, actually a lot with Aaron Rodgers. Like, every day the Packers wait, the less they're going to get for him, because he's going to leave and it's going to happen. And it's just, it's if Lillard wants to leave, somehow it's going to occur. So if you get the sense that he wants to go, I guess you're going to blow everything up. I mean, you look at the Portland team, it's a very likable team. It's a competitive team. I don't know what you could add that would sort of make them elite without kind of an obvious idea of taking just some randomly selected player and putting him in there. I think there's a sense he's not going, that he's going to stay here. But I, it's really based on nothing. You know, it's like there's no reason to believe it or disbelieve it.
Yeah, it seems like when we were growing up and even like post-college, if a guy was unhappy, sometimes you kind of wrote it out and it could work, right? Like Hakeem Olajuwon's a good example. He was really unhappy in Houston. They almost traded him. They decided not to trade him. They kept him. And then he had the best 3 years of his career and he won 2 titles and had, you know, cemented himself as a top 15 guy. I think nowadays that he probably just would have forced his way out because there doesn't seem to be a backlash against the player anymore for a variety of reasons we can go into. But now there's a player really has nothing to lose if he wants to just say, screw it, I'm going to leave. And I think you're right. I think it's where the league's going. Once there's a hint that the guy has the foot out the door, it just seems like it's over. What is the modern example of somebody being like, oh, I've rethought this. I'm actually now I've decided to be happy here. Once the foot's out the door, it seems like it's done.
Well, I think in the past, it was not uncommon for the media to side with the players and the audience and the fans not to. Like with Jabbar or whatever in the 70s, wanting to leave Milwaukee.
Yeah.
I think that the average person looked at that and thought that was completely inappropriate. But I think there were some people in the media who were like, well, these guys are what the league is built around. They should have agency over their life. They should have all this control. Now that's the general opinion. I think the progressive idea now seems to be that in any situation where it's a player and management, you should sort of ideologically side with the player. You could give all these different reasons. Like when Harden wanted to get out of Houston, you could give all these, like they changed the whole team for him. They did everything they possibly could. They gave him all these different sort of, collections of talent, seeing if this would put him over the top. But ultimately, you're like, well, he should be able to have some control over what his life is like. That seems to be what you're supposed to think now. If audiences feel that way, like if the fan bases seem to think that, I don't know how you can stop people from leaving. Because if they're the only real way you could stop people before would be to argue, this will ruin your legacy. People will hate you here. They'll never get over this. And now, if you make that argument to someone, the player can be, that's not true. LeBron left Cleveland. When he came back, they loved him more. There just isn't any kind of residue left over from leaving a franchise. It doesn't seem to change how people are remembered.
Yeah, I wonder if Durant leaving OKC is going to be the last time somebody took serious shit for that, right? And that was when I got to know him a little bit because I was one of the, I was in a weird twist. I was just on the other side of it. I was kind of like, I can kind of understand why he would leave. I think he's chasing some higher level of basketball and he had this opportunity to play with all these guys and he just really wanted to do it. But the response in OKC when he came back, all that stuff, I don't think we'll see that again, you know, and there's still some residue, right? The Mavs fans were booing Rondo every time he had the ball in the Mavs Clipper series. He didn't play that much. Houston, Harden went back there. They tried to, their hearts really in it, weren't really in it because their team was so bad. But I think for the most part, that Durant OKC thing will be the last time people would just be furious that somebody left.
Well, yeah. I mean, that it's a very delicate thing though, because I think now for people really engaged with pro basketball, they're sort of like, this is how it is now. The game has changed on the floor. The game has changed off the floor. This is sort of the game we watch now. But I do think that it has a negative impact on casual fans. Mm. And that's why I sort of feel like I told you this when you texted me about this podcast. It's like, it seems pretty clear to me the Nets are going to just walk through the playoffs and win the title. And during that whole period of the playoffs, that will actually be interesting. People will, be drawn to this idea that there's this seemingly unbeatable team. Can they be beaten? And if they are, if someone does take them out, I think that will be kind of a real sort of exciting thing. But if they don't, if they just kind of go through it and nobody really challenges them, it's going to be odd. I think there's going to be this real sense of why should I follow a sport where they don't care about the regular season at all? They can kind of compile a team inorganically that has incredible success at a very high level. You know, like it's fun to watch him play, but it does seem to me like the NBA is putting themselves in a dangerous position by letting all of these various threads sort of go to their logical extension. Like it doesn't seem like a good thing to me.
Yeah. I mean, if you take it individually, it's manageable. But if you add the five things together, it becomes a little less manageable. Like you mentioned the regular season. There's a bunch of reasons that they're in a bad spot with that. But like, you know, I used to love hockey as much as I love basketball when I was growing up, pretty much all the way through college. But the regular season became so meaningless that I just started watching in the playoffs. Because it was like, there was just no rhyme or reason to what happened in the regular season compared to what happened in the playoffs. And at some point, you just look at it and you go, well, I have better ways to spend my time. I don't love hockey that much. I don't need to watch.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that was the same thing they said about the NBA in the 70s and the early 80s. And that didn't stop you from falling in love with it. So I don't think I still think there'll be people
that was different, though. The issue with the regular season in the 70s was it didn't seem like the players cared.
Exactly. But wasn't this the same with the Nets? Like Kyrie would take a day off against the Timberwolves because he was sort of worried about other things.
Right.
And that's not a criticism. I mean, that's the way he kind of perceives it, you know?
Like right.
it would be interesting. I got to say, like, it would be fascinating to me if like Kyrie elected not to play in, say, the first game of the Eastern Conference Finals because it was like, I don't know, China's in Tibet or something. Like, he has some reason that something happens in the news that he finds real meaningful. Because he was always, like, missing a game, like a road game against the Timberwolves or something. You know, like, it would be interesting. It would really validate all his claims, all the things that he sort of presents himself as, if he elects, while fully healthy, to skip an incredibly meaningful game. Although, if Harden is back, it might not be that meaningful. It seems like if they have two of their three guys playing, they can pretty much beat anyone the way the game is played now.
Well, hey, they might have four guys now with the Blake Griffin's rejuvenation. They might be the big four instead of the big three. I do think someone mentioned this to me a couple weeks ago, and I mentioned it on the pod before, but I'm going to repeat it. If the players and the teams don't care about the regular season that much, and they're doing like the load management and they're just throwing games away, or even like near the end of the season, tanking the last two so they could go a seed down, stuff like that. At some point by osmosis, the fans aren't going to care as much either. Right. Because they're like, well, you know, I bought tickets for a Friday and so-and-so didn't play. So maybe I'm not going to do that again. I do think there's some real danger with that stuff.
Weren't NBA ratings down 49% this year?
They were, and there's probably a variety of reasons to it, but yeah, it's a significant number. I think that's one thing. The other thing I was thinking, you know, it's become clear this week that unless Brooklyn, something substantial happens on an injuries front or whatever, that they're going to win the title. They're just, the fact that they've destroyed Milwaukee like this, I thought Milwaukee was the best chance to beat them. So if you go back to 2019, when Durant gets hurt, but if he doesn't get hurt, I think the Warriors win that year too. And I think they win three in a row. So basically that would mean the last five titles would be decided basically by somebody saying, I'm going to go play with these other great guys, right? It would be three straight Golden State. It would be the Lakers last year where Davis and LeBron clutch arranges that and they get to play together. And now this year with the Kyrie KD thing. And if that's where the league is going, then I wonder like if there's going to be as much fascination with the off seasons and things like that, because ultimately there's between 7 and 10 great players every year. And if three of them are just going to team up here and two are going to team up here and two there, just what happens to the other 25 teams? Which brings us back to the Portland thing. If Dame doesn't find the second great person for him to play with, he's just never going to win a title. And I think you look at the formula now and you're like, there's no other way to do this. I have to find other players as good as me or I will never win the title. What happened with Dirk in 2011 will never happen again.
I guess I disagree with you about the offseason stuff. Won't that become amplified? Because that will become more meaningful than the season. Like what's going on in June and July? Well, I guess what will the months be now? What will be the, it will be August, September,
yeah,
October.
Just for this year, yeah, and then it'll go back.
That will be a more significant period than December, January, February. And that's why I feel like the fan base for the NBA now, and in some ways, I think this is being shaped. It's possible that Silver is somewhat consciously doing this, that he's sort of recognizing that it doesn't seem like professional basketball as a visual kind of entertainment can compete with football or with a lot of other things that seem to be rising in the culture. But what they can dominate is sort of this idea of a kind of like this constantly online person who is almost interested in the business and the transactional aspect more than what's actually happening on the floor. So as the way things are going now, I think it will probably increase interest in the offseason in the same way the NFL has been able to sort of just, you know, ratchet up interest in the draft and the release of the schedule and all of these things that, you know, it is bizarre how what we're moving toward, but what we're kind of moving toward is something that maybe is predictable. This idea that sports are now more interesting to people as an economy than they are as a sport. Like they are more, like look at the big Kevin Durant story that was in the New York Times Magazine last weekend. Like, is that really a story about basketball or is that a story about sort of the idea of like what a basketball player is supposed to represent now in the culture? I don't know. I mean, I still... My predominant relationship is still with the games themselves. And I'm often watching them with the sound off, so I'm really just seeing basketball. Mm. And I was probably more engaged with the NBA this year than I have been in, I don't know, 20 years or something. Partially because I was in a couple fantasy leagues and partially because I was also just stuck, you know, and that seemed the most like life. Like it seemed the most like the way normal life used to be or whatever, is watching these games with the sound down. So for me, it's like, it's not like I'm losing interest in the NBA, but it does seem like, as always, the NBA is in trouble. As it's been my whole fucking life, the NBA has been in trouble. There's never been a time when the NBA didn't seem like they were in some kind of catastrophic crisis. Like they exist in that world where it's just always a problem.
Yeah, I was thinking with the offseason stuff, like let's say Detroit signs Lonzo Ball. You know, 10 years ago, I'm like, oh, Detroit signed Lonzo Ball. Interesting. Man, it could be a piece. You could put. Now it's like, all right, well, they signed Lonzo Ball. They still have 0% chance to win the title. I think I'm more cognizant maybe in 2021 of just how many teams have zero chance, you know? And I even look at a team like Portland where you just go, they probably have zero chance to win the title. I don't know if I would have said that 3 years ago. Maybe I was just more naive about the concept of stars teaming up. But now that...
Well, then let me ask you this. Okay.
Yeah.
How many teams this year do you think have a legitimate shot to win the title of the teams that remain?
Before this week, I would have said like 7.
Okay. And now you would say 1?
I just don't see a roadmap for, I hate to be reactionary after 2 games, but the fact that they're role players in Brooklyn, like that they also hit a home run with some of the guys who aren't even like,
yeah, well, their role players are good. That's the thing. Like Joe Harris is good.
I mean, Joe Harris is good. Bruce Brown is good.
Yeah. But you know, it's kind of idiotic of us to say that because before Durant and Irving came back last year. Granted, some of those guys are gone now, but that was a pretty good team. You know, yeah. A lot of those dudes are out, but they got something back for them. I mean, it does seem like the way the game itself has changed.
That's the thing.
It plays into this, whereas say in the 90s when like the Rockets put like Akeem and Clyde Drexler and Barkley together, it's like just, it was the belief was this never works. Or like when the Lakers got Payton and Karl Malone, it was like, see, this never works. And now it seems like it always works. That's why I do have to, I will see what you think of this. Okay. So one thing I often see people say when they're bemoaning this in the same kind of reactionary way you and I are doing is they're like, you know, Jordan would have never done this. Jordan would have never done this.
He would have done it.
He would have had to have, right?
Yes.
Because if we believe that Jordan is the most competitive person, a person who will cheat a grandmother at cards, somebody who'll do anything to win, if this is the best way to win,
he would have done it.
Seems like he would have done it. So maybe this would have always happened. In which case, then it isn't so much a change in the culture, but a problem with how players move. And that maybe the NBA has to find a way to limit this, because this is like, I don't know. I have a feeling that sometimes you and Russillo talk about this. You kind of talk around it, though. It's like you talk about this issue, but not directly. Which is that, like, what is the purpose of something like the NBA or any pro sport? I mean, if it is to be a form of entertainment, sort of giving people this kind of agency and freedom is going to dilute the product to a point where it's all going to collapse. Like, we almost work from the premise now that a pro athlete is supposed to be able to sort of pursue their dreams and make an intense amount of money. And like, that's actually like kind of a right. But these are leagues. Like, these are constructed things. This is a false kind of reality. And I don't know if this is like we were talking about the tennis player in the French Open. Yeah. You know, if somebody says, like, how do you feel about this? You know, how do you feel about her doing this? You know, I mean, you've got to say, it's like, I support her. You've got to support people who feel sort of uncomfortable and all this, you know. But like, in a larger sense, it does sort of kind of work from this idea that, like, tennis is supposed to exist as it exists. And it's supposed to be this incredibly lucrative, kind of meaningful thing. It's like, it exists because people are interested in it. So if we sort of say, you don't have to do anything that keeps people interested in your game, it's eventually going to put the whole enterprise in jeopardy. Now, her individual case is not. In fact, I have to say, I didn't even know the French Open had started until that happened. Like, right. I mean, it's not like her not talking at these press conferences hurt the profile of the French Open. But it is an odd thing. I mean, I think it kind of goes back. We used to talk about, like, Popovich not playing guys on a Friday night when a game was on TNT. And he wouldn't play Duncan and Ginobili, and it would be this weird thing, you know. It's like, and the natural reaction as a basketball fan was to be like, well, he's not supposed to worry about TV ratings. He's not supposed to worry about the fan experience. His job is to win a title. And if resting his players on a Friday night is the best way to do it, he should do it. But that suggests that basketball is like a real thing. It's not a real thing. It's like a game that was invented and we put it on TV to make an entertaining product. That's its purpose. So you kind of have to do those things, even if they seem completely ancillary to the job you were hired to do.
We're going to take a break. I have some thoughts on what you just said.
Jahr für Jahr nehme ich mir vor, dieses Weihnachten wird entspannter. Und diesmal hat's wirklich geklappt. Früh mit Idealo verglichen und Preiswecker gestellt. Egal ob für Spielzeug, Tablets oder Parfum. Und am Ende konnte ich sogar mehr Wünsche erfüllen. Der Preis ist wow, und immer low, oh.
Idealo, low. Ho, ho, ho. Hol dir jetzt die Idealo-App. Schenke viel und spare noch mehr.
All right, so what you're talking about it, when things can shift certain ways and it inadvertently hurt the competitiveness of the league. So this happened in baseball, right, in the 2000s, where the money became kind of untenable for how much money the Red Sox and the Yankees, and I think there were like two other teams, could spend. They could basically just have a payroll that was 2.5 times as much as everybody else, right, with no real repercussions. And we're headed toward this world where it just seemed like for a couple of years there that every single year it was going to be the Red Sox or the Yankees winning the World Series or whoever else wanted to spend that kind of money. I think soccer is in this position now with, you know, like you look at the Premier League and a team like Man City can just splurge and there's 7-8 soccer teams that can just spend crazy amounts of money and they're just going to have a way more realistic chance of winning. So we've seen stuff. I just don't know how to prevent it with basketball, because if you look at what happened with the Nets, it was pretty organic. Durant and Kyrie played out their contracts. They wanted to play together. They went to a team that was in a big market that had saved a lot of cap space for them, right? So you have that. They already had a couple good players. They brought in a coach who is really savvy offensively, who is one of the great offensive point guards we've had, who figured out a way to utilize all these pieces. And then at the same time, the game is shifting toward offense, 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 as Russillo was laying out on Sunday, where the offensive ratings have just through the roof for 8 or 9 teams in ways that have no parallel historically. So you have this teaming of events that happens a little like with the 2017 Warriors, and you just look at it and you go, well, fuck. How? What could have stopped that? There's no rule that could have changed or fixed any of that, which I think makes a lot of fans, maybe they're not against it, but they're just kind of like, there's a helplessness to some of this stuff that I think goes back to the 80s, where it was like, all right, if you have Bird or you have Magic or you have Michael, you have a really good chance to win the title. You might have the 89 Pistons path. You might have the early 90s Blazers path, but for the most part, you need one of those guys. And it was the same level of helplessness. Now it's just shifted.
Well, there was a period where the way it worked, always that the team possessed the player could pay him more to keep him from jumping. You know, I think that's still the case. But the salaries are so high now, it makes less of a difference. I mean, it's sort of like if you're, you know, buying a house for $780,000, and for some reason, it turns out at the last minute you can save $40,000 by buying a different house. It's like, well, I'm already paying $780,000. You know, I think that for a lot of these guys, it was sort of like, well, I'll go somewhere else. It's like, yeah, I'll leave $14 million on the table. It's like I can't spend the money I have. You know, it's like right. I think that's part of it. Just the salaries went up so much, but also
they could make the money off the court too, and make up the difference if they're in a big market.
I mean, like you can't blame the guys in the present, like the guys doing it now. Everybody has to do what's best for them in the moment. Like if all the Ringer employees found a way to get their salary moved up to $300,000 a year,
oh,
of
Jesus.
Course they'd have to do it. But then it wouldn't exist. The whole thing wouldn't exist at some point. You know, it's like you can't expect that these players to be like, well, we're not going to do what's best for us in the moment because this could damage the league in 10 years from now. Pro basketball could be less popular. That's kind of what the commissioner has to do. I mean, I think the commissioner's main job in any sport, it always got to go like, well, he just works for the owners. Well, yeah, but the main thing he needs to do or she needs to do is kind of protect the integrity of the game itself. That's why I think it's like, I think the NBA should, I think it would be to their advantage to help out the college game, to make the college basketball more vibrant and more robust. I think that would be better for basketball as a whole. Like you just like people care about these things and spend money on these things because they like the thing. They like basketball. And if you allow everyone to sort of do what's best for them in a way that makes the thing less desirable, I mean, maybe it won't matter. Maybe it'll just kind of keep going on in perpetuity. Sometimes I think that too. That's like, so even if pro basketball becomes less popular, it's still a live event. It's still live sports. It'll still have a TV relationship. It will still, you know, like people will still want to go to something, and it won't really matter how misshapen that, even if it becomes more of a niche thing, it'll still be able to succeed. But I mean, I do think football has done a much better job at keeping the game somewhat similar to the game that people loved originally. I mean, it changes, of course, but they keep it more in check in a way that is believed to be or kind of considered to be draconian and like anti-labor and stuff like that. But these are not normal jobs. I mean, it's like every job is not the same. And that's the way we look at so sort of like the principles of like a coal miner and what his position should be is not the same as James Harden. It's just, you know.
Well, I think football, there's so many guys on the roster that it becomes, there's what, 4 or 5 guys who can swing the destiny of a team, right? Every year. There's the Rodgers, Mahomes type, and we just saw it with Brady and the Bucks, even though it's advanced Brady. But you think of like the 2000s, Manning and Brady every year. One of those guys is in the AFC title game, and there's 5 of those guys. But you can't really team up in football like this. Like you couldn't, you know, Rodgers couldn't say, I'm going to team up with I don't know, Julio Jones and DK Metcalf, and we're going to go play for the Chargers. There's no way to do that. Nobody would be able to construct the cap that way. And I think it's funny how this worked out, where the NBA in the late 90s, early 2000s, the long-term contracts were so disastrous for them, right? Where it was like, oh, we got to get out of this. Got to make the contract shorter. And then the shorter contracts inadvertently led to everything that happened the last 8-9 years. I think all of it is pretty natural and organic, and there's not much you can do about it. The only thing that I think Silver really needs to fix is like the Harden piece of it, where a guy can just, you know, basically quit on his team when he's making 35, 40 million a year, whatever he was making, and he could just be like, fuck it. And I'm going to behave a certain way until they trade me, and then goes to Brooklyn and he's super happy again. You have to fix that. There has to be some way to fix that.
But isn't that less fixable though? I mean, how can you, what fix can you employ to demand people to care?
Well, do you think the Rockets should have suspended him for 10 games without pay when he just wasn't showing up for anything?
They could have done that.
I guess it would have made no difference. Yeah.
He wouldn't have come back and like, well, okay, I'll play hard now. I mean, it was just, they could have done that. He probably would have been pleased by it, that he wouldn't have had to show up and that he wouldn't have had to like, you know, kind of go through these motions. And, you know, I don't think it would have bothered him. And I don't think, like, I'm not attacking the guy. I don't think he's some terrible person. I mean, I just think that he is, like anybody, wants to do what is best for himself.
Yeah.
And you can't blame people for doing that. That's why we can't look at these guys, these players, and be like, they got to be different or they got to change. They, of course, are going to do what's best for themselves. This is when someone has to step in from the outside and say, this is how it's going to be now. And, it's going to make him unpopular. I mean, it made Stern unpopular, but I think what he was, but in retrospect, the farther we get away from like Stern's tenure, Pete Rozelle's tenure and else, the better it looks to me. The better it seems like they had a better understanding of how to sustain a sport as opposed to sort of just dealing with the kind of the machinery as it moves.
Well, the counter to this would be like, well, so what? We have super teams all the time. So what if Brooklyn wins 4 titles in a row? They out-engineered, they out-thought everybody else. The Durant-Kyrie thing, I mean, if you just look at it from those two guys, where Durant was clearly unhappy in Golden State, Kyrie was clearly unhappy in Boston, they're really close friends. And they're like, fuck it, let's go play together. And then they basically orchestrated, they brought in the coach they wanted. They pulled out the Blake Griffin thing, somehow figured out how to rejuvenate him. I'm sure they have a hand in a lot of how they put it together. It's really kind of brilliant when you think about it. It's as brilliant as anything LeBron did. And why shouldn't they be able to do that? I have a tough time coming up with a counter to it.
I mean, the answer to me seems obvious. It's like, do people like it? This is still a form of entertainment.
Kevin Durant, do you care if people like it? Your goal is just to win the title.
Absolutely. It's for him. For him, he doesn't have to worry about whether or not even he personally is liked or disliked. He does seem to care about that. But you can't put the responsibility on, like, okay, if this is, I suppose, somewhat dehumanizing, but if you look at the NBA like a chessboard, and the various pieces are the players, and you know, like Durant and LeBron are the kings and the queens of this, and different players. You know, like, you can't look at the pieces and be like, well, it's their job to sort of make this game interesting. It's the rules of the game,
and the rule of the game people, is to win the game.
Yes, yeah. I mean, like it's not a problem for Durant, but I mean, it's a problem. The fact that, like, okay, so the NBA playoffs are on, you and I both love them. And yet, what are we talking about? The fact that it seems like this is troubling. When I'm in my car and I listen to guys talk on the radio, they seem to talk about two things: what happened in whatever game happened last night. And this is kind of a problem. We're like kind of in this weird impasse where it seems as though where we went from one situation, you know, in the past where the players had no control, where now they have most of the control. And it's something in the middle seems to be the best way to do it, you know? But,
But for, yeah, you're talking from a competitive standpoint.
From a competitive standpoint, but also just sort of from an interest standpoint. I mean, you could the argument could be made that this conversation is proof that this is good because we're talking about, you know, how this is going to play out. What does it mean when it plays out? It seems to be more than just guys playing basketball. Now it's sort of this idea of how the thing is run or whatever. But another part of me is like, I don't know. It seems misshapen to me. Like it doesn't,
You know what the most interesting, here's a result that would give you hope, right? That there's some sort of solution for this. The Lakers, because we had a shortened season, they end up with a 7 seed. They're not 100% healthy going into the series. Then Davis gets hurt. They're playing the 2 seed, Phoenix, who's a really good team who was healthy, even though Paul got hurt for a couple of games. And they just lose. They have bad luck. So why did that happen? Because the season was shorter and LeBron going down for 20 games or whatever it was really seesawed it for them. They went from being a potential 2 seed to a 7 seed. All these obstacles down in front of them. They don't have home court advantage for any part of the playoffs. And made me think, remember when Leicester City won the Premier League that year and people were talking about how incredible it was and blah, blah, blah. But that it actually wasn't, it was incredible, but it wasn't as incredible. There was no NBA corollary to it because it could never happen in the NBA because they play so many games. Whereas in soccer, there were less games, less schedule, which means more variance. And I was wondering with the NBA regular season, maybe that's part of how we solve this. Maybe we need, I mean, maybe it should be like a 60 game regular season where there's just the games are just way more important. You can, if you lose somebody for 2 weeks, it could be really hurtful. If you have a guy just skip out for a week, it could be really damaging and you're a lower seed. And basically the Lakers would be the model for that. Now they would say we can't do that because we give up, we lose so much revenue. I still feel like, to lose so much revenue standpoint, to have more scarcity of the product, to have it mean more to go to a game, to have it mean more to watch one on TV, I would argue that's a better path. They'll never do it, but...
Oh, of course they'll never do it. My friend Brandt once brought up a point. I wonder what you thought of, would think of this. Okay. How interested in baseball would you be if baseball radically reinvented itself and adopted football schedule?
Just had a 17 game regular season.
Well, actually, I guess not quite football, more like college hockey. There would be a game Friday and a game Saturday. Those would be the only two games of the week. So those two nights would be the only two nights you could watch baseball and follow baseball. I feel like bars would be insane on those nights. I feel like and every game would be basically your best pitcher would pitch and your second best pitcher would pitch the next night. So every one of these games would be 2-1. 1-0, it would be, you know, I think that I would follow baseball pretty closely if there was two games a week.
Well, it seems like
and every team is playing on Friday and Saturday. So if you follow your own team, you wouldn't really even see the other teams. All you'd see are highlights because all the games would be on the exact same time, across the coast. So like you just, you know, so you would, it would be like a real kind of limited experience. And I think that would obviously completely change the whole sort of concept of baseball, which is that they want it to be this sort of long, drawn out thing. Yeah. But I think it'd be real cool if it was only two games a week.
And yeah, every game say was three. Great. It's like the three game series every weekend, and that's it.
Yeah,
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
It could be Friday, Saturday, and then Sunday afternoon. Those are the 3 days baseball happens.
It's interesting. Yeah. I think baseball is in a good spot because baseball. Their calling card is basically, we're on all the time. Every night we're here for you. Sometimes the games might be good. Other times it might be a 12-2 game. But I think they're just kind of the comfortable blanket.
I thought you were like, baseball's dead. Kids hate it.
I'm kind of back on baseball.
How did that change?
I think because the Red Sox got good again. I think I just started enjoying it.
Okay, here's
maybe
the other
we're
thing.
All just crazy. Okay. I was more into playoff hockey this year than I've been in the last 8.
Okay, so tell me this. Okay, so when Trey Young was at Oklahoma, I remember you texting like, this is the best freshman I've ever seen play basketball.
Still feel that way.
Then you hated him for like a long period, and now you like him again. What happened?
Hate's a strong word.
Yeah, well, you were very hard on
sports. Hate it. No, listen. I'm pretty consistent on this. When it's somebody putting up stats,
uh huh,
on a bad team that's constructed to make that guy look good at the expense of things that actually work for a winning whatever, I'm just not going to like it. I'm just going to tell you, if the next time the situation happens, I won't like it again. I think what happened over the last 3 months is he figured out how to become a winning point guard. And I think I'm telling you, I watched it happen.
So you think that 5 months ago, he was a different person.
I think he was the first third. Look at his stats, the first 35 games of the season versus what happened after.
So what was he at Oklahoma? What was he at Oklahoma?
Well, Oklahoma, that's just, he's a really fun college basketball player who was a one-man show.
Was he good?
Yeah, but he was a one-man show in Oklahoma.
Was he great?
I thought he was great in college.
Okay, so you thought he was great. Okay, so then he got, it seemed as though you really held something against him because of the Luka and the draft, and like, you kind of got on one ship, and then like, and even though Luka's awesome, slightly overrated.
I love all good basketball players. I love all good basketball players. I just don't, the style that he was playing with, I was just like, why are people celebrating this? They lose. Great. He scored 30. He took 28 shots. Everybody else stood around and watched him. What's fun about this? I think what's amazing this season is how he transformed over the course of the season. Now the shit he's doing is like high level Steve Nash, mid-2000s stuff. Like he's picking apart these teams. He was not doing this
consistently
4 months ago. The team's better.
The team is better. That's a huge part of it. I don't know if his style has changed at all. It seems like he shoots a higher percentage and as a consequence is shooting a few less shots a game. But, you know, I mean, a lot of times he would have those horrible games where he'd go like 7 for 28 because he had to take like 11 shots in the last 4 minutes because they were down 20 or whatever. And that probably, but I don't feel like his game has radically, is any different. He does the same stuff to me.
I completely disagree. And I've argued about other Atlanta fans with this. I think he has a much better sense of the pace of the game and how he can throw his team off by doing certain things. Before, you know, he would just take these 32-foot shots down 6 with 4 minutes left and it would be a brick and the other team would score and the game would be over. Like, he's much savvier about the risks that he wants to take. And even like, I don't know, there's a real unselfishness with him now. And his teammates have talked about it. I mean, I don't think that was a really happy team until they changed coaches. And I think the new coach had a real effect on them.
How many assists did he average last season?
I don't know. I don't know about the stats part. I'm eye testing this. With point guards, there's a certain sense when you watch them that they have a feel for the game, their team, the pace, when to kind of assert themselves, when to pull back. There's all these mechanics to it that I just didn't think he understood until the last couple months. Maybe.
So when did you see the switch flip?
When they went on their winning streak. They won like 8 or 9 games. Bogdanović came back.
Right after the coaching change.
He started trusting his teammates to hit shots and then started to figure out kind of that balance of, if I do too much, then these guys don't, then they're not involved enough. And then when I actually need them, they're not going to be ready. And he just kind of got it. And now you think like what he did to Philly in that first half, if the defense is saying, like what Philly was basically like, we're not going to double you. Here's Danny Green. If you can beat him, God bless you. And he's like, cool. And he just beat Danny Green for the entire first half. That's what he should have done. Then they started pressing in the second half and he's like, all right. And then he figured out that part of it. It's like, to me, it's like watching a quarterback where you can see it with quarterbacks where you're like, oh, he gets it. You know, and that's what I saw. I mean, maybe I'm nuts, but just watching him, I didn't enjoy watching him. The last couple of months, I really enjoyed watching him.
Well, okay. So that's interesting. I felt like you were really tough on him for a while.
Because he's talented. I believed in his talent and I didn't think he was, he was getting rewarded for the right things.
Weren't you like the Hawks are better when he's not on the floor? Wasn't that your position for a while?
No. There was a stretch for a couple games when Bogdanović was in there, when everybody was involved and they looked better. And it's like, that's kind of illuminating if your best player is not out there and the team seems like they're responding. But now he's been awesome. And I'm psyched that we have another good point guard, because that was a position that I was worried was going to go down the tubes. The other thing is, I love the stuff he did at MSG. Because I think the whole concept of sports villains and just having people that go into an arena and being like, fuck these guys, and have a little chip on their shoulder, I feel like that's going away a little bit. And he kind of brought it back. in a way that, and I know a lot of people have talked about it, but I just liked watching somebody go into that place and just be completely unafraid of it and kind of fuck with it a little bit. You don't see it that often.
Yeah, well, and it was odd that, like, you know, when the games were played without fans, of course that stuff didn't exist because there was like nobody, like, you know, you were playing kind of in these empty barns but when you're watching the game, you know, it's like, it was very easy to forget the building was empty.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of Trae Young and just the basketball players, because I wanted to mention this because we're talking about Dame Lillard, what's he going to do? And then people are like, well, I think Dame, and you said that whole thing. Well, he's from Oakland. People here seem to think that's, we spend so much time psychoanalyzing these guys, like that Durant New York Times piece. And I obviously spent some time with Durant a few years ago and we did all those pods and just, we have such a better sense of who we think these guys are. And I was trying to think, like, did we think this way in the 80s and the 90s? Like, did I spend any time at all wondering what kind of person Larry Bird was? Like, we judged them by the basketball stuff, right? We weren't like, oh, I wonder what Larry thinks about this, or I wonder how Larry's feeling about things. Like, I just, when Larry was upset, when he would like criticize teammates, like he did in the 84 finals, or like when he was unhappy in the late 80s because the coach they didn't like, and it was like, Bird's not happy with the coach. It was like, oh my God, Bird's not happy with the coach. It was like, felt like a bombshell. And now it seems like we just have this unfiltered connection to all these players. Social media plays a part of it. I feel like I know these guys better. Like Durant last night, the guy, I don't know if you saw the post-game interview, it was Jared Greenberg. And it was like his last question. And he said something like, hey, 2 years ago tomorrow was when you hurt your calf. Did you think you would be able to be as good 2 years later as you are right now? And Durant was just like, what kind of question is that? That's your question? And just started like turning and making fun of him. And on the surface, you'd be like, oh, Durant's being a dick. But it was like, honestly, that was the most KD moment he's had in an interview where he's just like, he was disappointed the guy asked a dumb question. So he made fun of him. The guy reframed it. They made fun of each other and he kind of lifted it. But I guess my point is, like, I feel like we know, in a weird way, we know these guys way better than we used to. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I don't know if it just applies to sports. Here's something I think has happened. I'll see if you agree with me. I don't know if you will. But say you look over the 90s, the first 10, 15 years of the 21st century.
Yeah.
The television becomes dominated sort of by reality television. The most popular form of nonfiction writing usually becomes some sort of memoir or memoir-like writing. The internet starts to exist and social media comes with it, although not till a little later. I think one thing that has happened that was, I don't know I'm sure this happened in the past, but it seemed less central to the experience of this, which is this idea now that when people see the behavior of an athlete or an actor or a writer or any kind of celebrity, there's now this sort of natural inclination to project yourself into that person and assume that the decisions they're making must in some way mirror the decisions you would make if you were them.
Mm.
So like we look at somebody like, when Durant, for example, you know, when he was like using all those burner accounts to sort of stick up for himself on Twitter. I think that in the distant past, if there had been some corollary to this, people would have been like, that's weird that he did that. Or that's wild that he did that. But now I think the natural move is to be like, okay, if I did that, what would that mean? Well, it would mean obviously that I was insecure about my perception. Or it would mean that I'm worried about my brand because I have other sort of monetary ideas. Or it would mean that I'm a real person. And that's just how it feels to be, you know, injured, you know, verbally or whatever. I think that a lot of what has happened in media has prompted, it's made the gap between the viewer and what is being viewed less. I mean, like reality television, The Real World was a perfect example of this, where people would watch The Real World and they would tend to look for the character that they felt was their avatar for themselves in that house. Which of these people is most like me? And that was expected. That was part of it. It was like these shows work you know, Survivor works or Big Brother works or any of these shows, The Bachelor works, because people will find this character and say that that's me. You know? So now I think people kind of do that all the time. So when we think about these guys, we feel like we know them better. We feel like we know actresses better because we imagine that they are us in this weird way, or we are them. And that the, and that, that we can explain their behavior by thinking about what we would do in the same position. Does that seem possible?
Do you think, yeah, but do you think the fact that people have actual access to these people now, even if they're in their replies, versus what we had 30 years ago, where it doesn't seem inconceivable that a celebrity could hear from you?
It's not inconceivable. It's totally conceivable.
30 years ago, it was inconceivable. The only way they're going to hear from you is if you went to see them in a concert, or if you went to their game, or if you ran into them at a restaurant. Or it's such a, like, it would have to be some bizarre.
I mean, and it was situation. And when that was the situation, it was like, this person's not like me. And now the minute they respond to you, you're on the exact same plane. If Kevin Durant responds to a tweet you send to him, he is basically saying, we're on the same level now. This is the same thing we're talking. So I suppose maybe that does make it easier to feel like you have an idea of what he actually is like.
Yeah. Well, and especially podcasts have really helped us too, because a lot of these different people have done those long form interviews, and you do get a sense of person way better than you're going to get on, like, if they're on Access Hollywood or if it's like a People magazine story or something.
But like, here's another thing though. It's like, okay, so like you're talking about Larry Bird in the 80s, and we would just kind of look at Larry Bird, and occasionally you'd see a photograph of him. He was smoking a cigarette, and it would be surprising or whatever. And a picture of him smoking a cigarette is how you would have to figure out all these other things about it. You know, now if let's say the 80s are happening now, anytime Larry Bird does something, well, you turn on the television, Rachel Nichols talks about what she thinks he's like, and then Brian Windhorst does. And then, you know, you go to flip it, then Jalen Rose is talking about him with Jacoby. And all of these people have given a version of what they think he is like and the reason he did these things, and or like what his personality is. And you kind of unconsciously build a composite of that.
Right.
I mean, you take all these things, all the speculation that people have said, and then you kind of put it all together like into a ball of yarn. And then it's like, see, I have this clear understanding of what this person is like, when it's all different people just sort of expressing what they think might be the case. And if enough of those things match up, it kind of becomes true. It's like, you know, there was a line on an old record by the Streets where he's talking about, it's like, people say, don't believe everything you read. But everybody does. And that is fucking true. Because even if they know it's fake, even if they know the thing they're reading is fake, it's like, but some people think that. So there must be a reason some people think this. Like it is weird. It's not weird, actually. It's obvious. Yeah.
We're taking a break. I want to continue. I have one more point on this. All right, coming back, we're talking about whether we know athletes and celebrities better now than we used to. I was thinking about how important, especially when we were growing up, the takeout feature was. So you mentioned that New York Times piece about Durant. I actually thought that piece did a pretty good job of capturing what he's like, because there's like a natural curiosity about him that I always thought was really interesting in the time I spent with him. Like he's really genuinely curious. Like I remember... he got in trouble when he went on CJ McCollum's podcast a couple years ago. And CJ's like, if we can win the title, or he said something like that. And Durant was like, wait a second, you think you have a chance to win the title? And was like really confused and curious about it. That's who he is. I think he's a curious guy. Back in the day though, those takeout features, and the most famous one for sports was probably the Kornheiser piece that he wrote about Rick Barry, which was just, and this was after Rick Barry had retired, but he wrote that one piece and it completely framed how everybody thought of Rick Barry for the rest of the decade. Those takeout features were so important. And now I don't trust them nearly as much, because if you're getting access with somebody for one of those things, odds are there's some conditions, you were picked for a reason, things like that. I remember when you did something for GQ about Brady, mm-hmm. and you mm-hmm. got in trouble. What year was that?
what year was it? It was
within the last 10 years, right?
I think it was, yeah, it was 2015, because Trump was running for president, but didn't seem like he had any possibility of being elected.
And what was the thing, what was the question you asked that they were like, wait, and it got tense?
Well, no, because so they asked me, he was man of the year. He was going to be their man of the year. And they're like, do you want to do a profile of him? And I was like, well, I want to ask him about Deflategate. That's the only thing I'm really interested in, because I think that he's as great a football player as he is, I don't think there's ever going to be a situation where he is particularly forthcoming about how he thinks or feels, because I think he assumes that would be some kind of competitive disadvantage. Now, here again, I'm kind of projecting maybe what I think onto him, just like I was saying before. But I was like, I want to talk to him about this. And they were like, sure, go ahead. And that he was not informed that that was going to happen. The guy who said you can ask him anything was not the guy who actually talked to Brady about what could not be asked.
Yeah, because I think people and the people around them are so much smarter about what they say in those pieces. You go back, and they're offline now, unfortunately, but People Magazine, all of their archives used to be available from the 70s and 80s. They would write these features where they would be like, on the set of Three's Company, there's turmoil. And then you would read the piece, and people were so unbelievably candid. You were like, oh my God, I can't believe they said this. I can't believe Joyce DeWitt just completely murdered Suzanne Summers like that. How did she not realize they were recording this? And that was just kind of how it went in the 70s and 80s. And then if it was in the right hands of the right writer, they could craft a really awesome kind of snapshot of who somebody was.
Nothing was going to happen.
Right.
So people would be like, if people who read People Magazine might be like, Joyce DeWitt's different than I thought she was. But that's it. Like, there was no rippling effect that she had to worry about how this was going to, you know, that. So that's a big part of it. I mean, it's just like a, I don't know, when I was working at Spin in the early 2000s, there were a lot of publicists who seemed to think that it was to their advantage to sort of control the presentation of the artist. Like that we want Jack White to be presented in this way, or we want these things about the Beastie Boys to be what people think about the Beastie Boys or whatever. And, you know, it worked about half the time. Half the time the idea they had was an improvement. The other half of the time it was worse, and they'd been much better off letting the person be themselves. So it's just kind of, I mean, if you're the person who's being interviewed, I think generally you want, like, I hope the piece is positive. So, you know, that's kind of all you care about, I think. But, you know,
I think documentaries have kind of replaced those takeout features, because, and granted, a lot of the times with documentaries, they're being produced by either the artist, celebrity, athlete, whoever, or people around them. But then there's other times where you can, you know, I remember, what was the one you loved, the Oasis one?
The Oasis one was good. But you know, documentaries have this huge advantage in that you can hear what the words sound like when they are said.
And I mean, see
that
it. Tony,
that Kornheiser piece is great, and it did completely sort of galvanize the way people think of Rick Barry. But it is possible, if it was a documentary about Rick Barry at that point in his life, and him talking about some of the things that seemed just incredibly petty on the page, you might have heard him say those things and be like, well, that's probably true, though. Like, what he's saying seems right. I mean, like, you know, I remember a period where Adam Sandler basically said he would never allow himself to do like print interviews again. He would only do things that were on television, or would only do things, you know, in video form, because he was just certain that no matter what he said or what he expressed would be used by a writer who thought he had no talent to be kind of decontextualized and sort of placed as face value. I mean, that's always the thing, you know, it's like, obviously the worst thing you can do in journalism is make up a quote, but it's not that far off to use a quote accurately in a context that you know does not represent what the person was actually saying. And that happens all the time.
It's happened to me a few times.
I think anybody who's ever had a story done on them has had this happen, where it's like that, you know, that you can't tell if the person is saying this kind of off the cuff, or if they're saying this, sort of half jokingly, or if they're talking about a whole bunch of things and this is one thing they're also mentioning. It does sort of give this the documentary has the advantage of seeing the person say it, and you get a real sense of like how they meant it.
Yeah. All right, we talked enough about sports. It's time. America's on pins and needles. I can't believe it took an hour to get here. UFOs are real. I've been waiting to talk to you on this podcast. I've deliberately ignored talking to anybody else. We've done a lot of conspiracy stuff over the years on pods. I think what that Malaysian flight went down, I think we did an emergency podcast. You love this stuff as much as I do. Under the radar the last year, so much shit was going over the last years. The Pentagon, everybody else has basically just admitted that UFOs exist. And there's lots of encounters that they have no explanation at all for. And it seems to be a real thing that is in the world. And I just feel like 35 years ago, we would have had a heart attack. This is all we would have talked about.
You know, it's a fascinating thing. I mean, okay, here's sort of my take on this. I think for the longest time, 60s, 70s, 80s, even into the 90s, that when the U.S. government saw something or had evidence of something in the sky that made no sense, that didn't move the way it was supposed to move, or did, it was just could not be explained, their reaction was fear. This is the Russians. The Russians have a technology that we don't have, and we can't basically admit that they have developed a pill-shaped spacecraft that can move in any direction at four times the speed of sound or whatever. But then the Soviet Union collapses, and we learn all about their military science and their military technology, and turns out they were actually a little behind us. They had some stuff, but nothing like this. So then there was this period of like, well, so what? How do we explain this? How do we explain this? And they're like, we just can't kind of come forward with it. So it just sort of sat there. And I don't know exactly why it's coming out now, if it's because these guys are retiring and they're like, I'm going to talk about this, before I retire. But my overall point about this is UFOs are like climate change. And that's why it seems like it's under the radar, because you cannot say, I am the person who's into UFOs, I'm interested in UFOs, and then move to any other subject now. It would be like if Greta Thunberg came out and she was like, yeah, I'm really interested now in like privatized prisons. And people would be like, but wait, you were just saying the world's going to be gone in 40 years, and now you're worried about privatized prisons? If you say UFOs exist, and you don't think that they're just unidentified things, that we don't know what they are, that these are things from a different planet, everything else happening in the United States and the rest of the world is secondary. And it's almost too big of a thing to really focus on. It's like you just, everything about the concept of religion, probably everything about the concept of political science, the idea of what happens to any being when they die, what is sort of the meaning of living in one space when there are places to live elsewhere. It's like it's almost too much. And I think that people are afraid to take this seriously, because if you do take it seriously, it's going to nullify so many other things about day-to-day existence. If you're really going to view these things as alien spacecrafts. I mean, the fact that there's unidentified things, that doesn't mean so much. Just because we can't identify it doesn't mean it's from a different world. But, I mean, the connection seems to be hard to avoid. If we don't know what something is, we don't know where it's from. Where's it from?
So it makes me think, like, going back to the Roswell days, and I didn't know if I believed in UFOs or not. Like, I believe in certain things. Like, I definitely believe in ghosts. UFOs, I was always like, why are they always in these certain parts? Why have we never seen one in, like, New York City?
Wait. You definitely believe in ghosts?
I do.
Definitely?
Yeah, I do.
Because of experiences you've had or just...
Yeah, I believe in ghosts.
Okay, I mean, that's not an... I mean, people believe in ghosts. What happened to you?
I've talked about it. I had a ghost experience when I stayed at that Skirvin Hotel, and I was 100%, I completely changed my mind on ghosts. In 2010.
I don't know this.
I was staying there, and it was staying on the floor that allegedly had the ghost. I was like, put me on the floor because I love horror movies.
What hotel is this?
It's a Skirvin Hotel in Oklahoma City.
Okay. Okay. Are you there covering like the Thunder or something?
Yeah, I was there for the, I was there to go see a Thunder game. Or okay. A couple of Thunder games, actually.
Okay, so you say, put me on the haunted level of the hotel.
The hotel clerk was like, oh, you want to meet Effie, huh? Who was like the ghost they had. And I was asleep. And the thing about me is when I fall asleep, like I don't wake up. Like you could, you know, it's really hard for me to wake up. You would have to basically drive a bulldozer into the house. If I'm asleep, I'm asleep. And I woke up at, I don't know, like 3:45, 4 in the morning, because I felt like somebody was in the room with me and the hair in my arms were up and it was like no experience I ever had. And I was looking over the window and I was fumbling for my glasses and turned on the light and there was nobody there. And then I was like, somebody was in here. I know somebody was in here. And I couldn't fall back asleep. And I started Googling about the ghost, and it was about how the ghost had jumped out the window, and where I saw the person was, or where I thought the person was that wasn't there, was right next to the window. And then I didn't fall back asleep. I was just up the rest of the night because I was like, that was the most fucked up thing that's ever happened to me. And it was unexplainable.
Do you know what you need to do?
What?
You need to listen to the song Black Sabbath by the band Black Sabbath off their first record, Black Sabbath. That is about an experience very similar to yours.
Wow. Oh, I believed it after that. And then when I Googled it and it turned out the lady had this baby and jumped out the window with the baby. And I was like, well, I thought I saw something by the window and it just fucked with my head. I love horror movies. I love all that stuff. I do believe in ghosts. Anyway, UFOs, I never 100% believed in because I didn't understand why there weren't more interactions with them. I didn't understand why they're always in these obscure parts of the country and always in like the desert and like, but now that we have these different cameras and we're able to catch, there just seems like there's more interactions and it actually adds up.
So here was what you were like, kind of what was the consensus view you were supposed to have about aliens. Okay. It was always that the likelihood that aliens exist is extraordinarily high because the universe goes on for infinity and anything that can happen in infinity will happen. So the likelihood that there is a planet where life exists is mathematically beyond plausible. However, the assumption was also they would never actually be in touch with Earth.
Right, they'd never fuck with us.
Well, no, they'd never know it. We'd never come across it. The expanse of the universe is so great that the likelihood of someone being able to travel across it and happen to intersect with another planet that has it is just too remote, okay? So you thought it was interesting, like it would happen in the desert. There's a famous one in England, kind of happens in a forest. I guess it's true. Like there's never been like a UFO in like downtown Omaha. You know, it's like, that would be like, you know, it's like, you know, it never happens in like an urban area.
Or like over Las Vegas. Like it's always in these remote places. So that's why I was always a little suspicious.
Well, okay. So let's try to get into the mind of the alien. Okay, so if we are the aliens now, and we're visiting Earth, okay, the technology they have must be greater than ours because obviously we don't have the technology to get anywhere beyond Mars. Okay, we still don't. You know, we can't get people there yet. So their technology must be much greater. If their technology is much greater, it has to be because they've had more time, basically, to develop it. One assumes. So let's say they are 200,000 years ahead of us intellectually. Mm. Okay. So now we're the aliens, right? We're on Earth. We're going to a different planet. And we see people on that planet or creatures on that planet that are versions of hominids 200,000 years ago. What would we do? I think we would also try to watch them from a distance, right? If we saw essentially, you know, Neanderthals or like, you know, early humans, we wouldn't. You know, we would be so much more advanced than them. I think our fear would be if we interact with them in any way, they're not going to be able to handle it. They're going to freak out. It could change the trajectory of their whole society. So if aliens are visiting our planet and they're anything like humans, then they might be looking down at us almost the way we would look at, you know, like a chimp or something. And they're like, well, we don't want to, you know, we need to sort of keep our distance and just observe this. And maybe we can learn from watching them sort of advance. If these aliens are like humans, then that would completely validate lots of very classic ideas about Christianity. Like if the aliens are like us, like if they do seem similar to us, that would seem to suggest that they were created in somehow the same way. I mean, that would be a real interesting argument. If aliens show up and they have any human qualities, would that also sort of, I don't know, prove that humans are the apex of evolution? I mean, if they come off the ship and they're octopuses or whatever, that would be even more confusing.
Well, do you believe in reincarnation?
Do I believe in reincarnation? I'm open to lots of things. I've reached a kind of point in my life where almost anything that is offered to me, I'll be like, well, it could be.
If it's metaphysical.
I mean, yeah. The population of the world keeps increasing. So if it's people moving from, you know, person to person, that does mean a lot of new souls are also being created.
Good
because,
point.
You know, yes. But then
that's,
you know,
a Sloan conference also, point. Yeah. If the numbers are increasing, where do we get the souls? Yes.
But the thing is also, we also have, you know, lots of cattle. We have lots of dogs. We have, you know, maybe if reincarnate, you can't say, if once you say reincarnation is possible, then like the idea of trees being sentient, that's totally on the table. Then the idea of a rock having some sort of personality is possible. I mean, like, this is always the thing. It's like, you know, I remember having an argument with my sister one time about ghosts. And my sister was like, well, okay, if you're going to believe in ghosts, you have to believe all of these things. Like, they can't travel across water and all these things. And I'd be like, well, I don't know. Why is that? It's like, that's the human idea of a ghost. It's like, it's not like that if we believe one thing, you have to believe all the rules. Once something unbelievable happens, all the other rules kind of go poof. So, you know, the thing about the UFOs, I guess, is that you see the footage and the reaction of the pilots.
That's what freaked me out. Yeah.
Because, like, they don't know what it is. But is there footage of pilots freaking out over stuff that they don't know what it is? And then later they say, like, oh, that was a weather balloon. Like, we see the ones where they freak out and there is no answer, you know?
Yeah.
You watched the 60 Minutes piece on it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched that too.
It was deeply disturbing.
Well, why is it disturbing?
Just that 60 Minutes doing a piece on it made it seem way more real to me. Even though it already seemed real, there was news stories written about it. But when 60 Minutes has been kind of the real paper of record for a lot of different reasons since I've been alive. So when they were like, we're going to do a UFO thing, I'm like, holy shit, okay, this is really happening.
Okay. So you believe in ghosts. Do you want ghosts to be real? Or would you prefer to find out you were wrong?
That's a great question. I kind of like I like the idea of ghosts.
I totally fucking want ghosts if they're there. Like, I don't believe in ghosts, but I would want there to be. But you seem to be saying you definitely don't want aliens.
Well, think about how we grew up. The UFO alien culture has existed way before either of us were alive, right? It goes back to the early 20th century. And then it kind of has this kind of boom in the 50s. People get excited about it. You see movies about it. And then as our entire life, I remember going to see Close Encounters in the theater. What was that, like 1977? And the ship lands, and it's like, oh my God. And then E.T. was another one, and Superman. And then it kind of goes through. Then it becomes Blockbusters.
But all the examples you just gave, the aliens are fucking great.
No, I know.
Superman's great. E.T. was nice.
But then when we did the Blockbusters in the 90s, it was like, what if the aliens weren't nice? Yeah. And then it flipped. That, yes. And it's like, all right, now the aliens are declaring war on us. And that became a cottage industry. But aliens have been in our life in this pop culture way that it just seemed like that's what they were going to be, like this go-to for pop culture stuff that people loved. I never thought we would actually have to deal with them.
Well, I guess
we have to like come up with a plan for the weird aliens that are flying around now.
But it seems as though, like, I mean, I don't know. This might be like a, like, I often say this, how, like, although my politics are all over the place, I feel like in some ways I'm kind of fundamentally a conservative person, that I kind of want things to stay as they are. Very hesitant about, it seems like life is changing faster than I can accept it all the time. So by that argument, I should not want aliens because if aliens suddenly enter into our world, it's going to be some significant changes. I have some weird conversations. However, I guess part of me does want to, if there are aliens, I want them to show up in my lifetime. Like if that
you'd be disappointed if they came 100 years.
Well, yes, I would be. I think about this a lot. Like a guy who died the day before 9/11 or whatever. Like, you know, it's like it's interesting to it'd be like, I guess this is like sort of the larger question. Okay. Let's say the world is going to end. Mm. And it can end when you're 80 or 5 years after your death. What do you want? And here's the one thing: it will not be a painful end. So it won't be like you're burned. You won't be burned alive. It's not like the aliens are going to come and cover you in acid. You're not going to be eaten by zombies. The world will end suddenly and painlessly when you're 80 and you can see it. Or you can die and 5 years later it will happen and you'll never have to experience
it. I'd probably want to not experience it.
I'd want it. I'd want to see it.
So you're like Dreyfus in Close Encounters.
Yeah. Oh, I also love mashed potatoes. So, I guess in that way I am like, I wouldn't want the world to end today because I like my life, but if it was going
at the tail end,
at the tail end, or at least like, I want my kids to grow up and I want them to have the experience of being an adult, even if it's truncated, I guess. It would be the biggest event since the Big Bang, as far as any human is considered. I guess I would want to see what it's like. I would want to see how people react. I'd be curious what I would think about. You know, like what I'd be thinking about.
Well, we used to think about this during the 80s, right? When it seemed very possible that Russia and America might just blow each other up. Used to think a lot about, wow, what would happen? How much notice would we have before we all blew up? Be 5 minutes?
This is an interesting thing. I'm 49 and you're 50.
I'm 51.
Okay, 2 years. But even those 2 years make a big difference on this issue. Because by the time, like, say, post-war games kind of, or whatever, you know, when I was still in elementary school or whatever.
The day after.
That was the other one. Maybe I'm just speaking just from myself, but like, I was always like, it doesn't seem as though a country like the United States or a country like Russia would be willing to destroy itself. Like it seems like the stakes are obviously too high. In fact, I remember, I think I was in sixth grade because my dad was very proud of this. I wrote something in sixth grade about how the only problem would be is if Syria got a nuclear weapon. I don't think I knew anything about Syria in sixth grade. I'm sure I couldn't have found it on the map. I have no idea what Newsweek article I saw or something that prompted me to do this. So I never worried about the end of the world like that. But like, I found that people just a few years older than me really did. I think that it was, you know, like the first couple of years of the Reagan administration, I think made people kind of like seem scary, but you had to be aware of what was happening. Like you had to be aware of this. Like when they introduced the Star Wars program, that seemed good to me. I was like, oh great. Like lasers that can shoot missiles out of the sky. This is even better.
I felt the same. Yeah. There was a real fear that Russia was going to try to blow us up, which is how we end up with movies like Red Dawn. Like that was a real movie that got made where it's like Russia's going to invade us while being camps.
But what is interesting though is I'm surprised by the degree to which pop culture really did sort of shape your real life beliefs on these things.
Yeah.
Especially
in the 80s where it's just like books, movies, TV shows could have a profound impact. Like even like the JFK assassination, which we've talked about, where the underlying thing of that was, well, what happens if we find out the CIA murdered our president? Where do we go from there? And we still don't know. We're still not going to know. But if we found that out now, that's what happened.
Okay.
Would that affect how you think about the world in any kind of different way? The CIA and the mafia murdered JFK. They killed him. Because I think that's probably what happened. We just don't know for sure.
So if the CIA in orchestra with the mafia,
it was a coup d'état, yeah, basically. They killed
that they
our
agreed
president.
Somebody from the CIA went to like the Chicago mob and said like, we want to do this, and like, do we work from the idea
Let's
that
take
Sinatra
him out. Yeah,
was
we'll the, go yes, get sir. This Cuban guy. Okay. We'll just take him out.
I would be very surprised. I couldn't be totally shocked because obviously we've been talking about this for decades, you know. I guess I've now been socialized to believe the CIA is not necessarily a positive organization.
Right.
So I don't know if I, you know, and Kennedy did want to splinter the CIA. It would be weird if their reaction would be should assassinate him. I guess maybe not so weird. But my point though is that I just like when you're talking about like Red Dawn and stuff like that.
Red Dawn's an absurd movie, yeah. But I'm just saying like they're making movies where the Russians, where it's conceivable that all these weird scenarios, almost like with the aliens, right? There's this 4 or 5 year window where nuclear war became a pop culture scenario in movies and all these different things. Wait, we got to take a break and then quickly we got to do what you're watching. So you didn't watch The Mayor of Easttown?
No, I only watched the first episode. When we exchanged texts about this, it really hit me. Our television habits have become very different.
I would have bet anything you watched that.
My wife and I watched the first episode. You know, I like Kate Winslet. I thought it was a little better than she did, but we both felt like, we just kind of felt like we've seen this show before, which means it can still be good, but it seems like that now is a type of prestige television it wasn't so interesting that I was like, we got to keep going on this, but maybe if I'd have kept going, I'd have felt differently. I really want to watch The Bureau, but we haven't started that yet.
I want to watch that too. Like Mayor of Easttown. I think you would like The Kings, the Showtime documentary about the Sugar Ray Leonard era.
Yeah, I read that book that's kind of based on it. I think that they just bought the rights to it or whatever.
But there's no book could kind of own the IP from that
absolutely.
Era. It's about these four boxers, how they collided in different ways. It was cool. I thought it was well done. I thought it missed a couple things. It tried to push Ray almost as this creation of corporate America that I just disagreed with. I thought Ray was basically Tiger Woods.
I liked Hagler.
When Ray was coming up in the late 70s, he was like iconic because the Montreal Olympics, and he was like the Ali replacement. And I didn't feel like it got that part correctly, but I thought it was worth watching. You and I are both watching Pluto.
Yes.
Now, you're watching old music videos on Pluto. I just go on there because they have movies that I can't believe. Like last night, Angel Heart was on. I haven't seen Angel Heart or thought about it in a million years. And I was watching it like going, what? how did this movie happen? Like, how did the oldest daughter from the Cosby Show end up as the head of a voodoo cult with Mickey Rourke and then Robert De Niro playing Louis Cipher? And it turns out he's the devil in the end. And I was just kind of like blown away. But Pluto always has these little hidden gems that I just left for dead in the recesses of my brain, and they return.
You couldn't have been too surprised that the character named Louis Cipher ends up being
the
devil.
That was
the fact that, like, if I recall, every time he talks, the overhead fans start turning the opposite way.
And he looks like the devil.
Obviously, satanic move. But now Pluto has, like, it has a 70s and 80s and a 90s music channel where they just sort of show videos with no VJs. So sometimes I'll just kind of flip through those three back up and down. Watch this weird documentary about the movie Flash Gordon.
When did that come out?
It must have been in the last year or two. The movie came out in the early 80s. I never saw the movie. I only remember everyone saying it was terrible. But what is interesting is the way this documentary kind of presents Flash Gordon. It's like a classic. Like it's weird how, and you know, maybe in a way, sadly, Bill, you and I played a role in this, I fear, like this thing in culture where it's almost now, it's like, if you go back to anything that was sort of a failure and say it's interesting, somehow it makes it great. Like, I feel like I see this in lots of different things and lots of websites and this Flash Gordon thing is presented. Like this is like this very
like this
important
lost thing. Gem.
Well, like this, yes, and misunderstood, and like you know, Brian May is in it, and he's talking about Queen on the soundtrack, and you'd think that from the way he describes it, this was like a great moment in Queen's career, and it's also kind of a vanity project for the guy who played Flash Gordon because he's one of the producers, and throughout the documentary, it suggests that like
Sam Jones,
yes, him. And it consistently implies that, like, he made some bad decisions in his life, but now he's bounced back. But they don't really say what the bad decisions are, so I'm not sure what he did. I watched a really weird thing on the
NFL
Network.
Can I have a Flash Gordon point quick? Because I realized this. We did Raiders of the Lost Ark for the rewatchables. And I didn't realize Lucas was trying to buy the rights to Flash Gordon before he came up with Star Wars. So that must have been in the doc. I had no idea. Initially, he wanted to do Flash Gordon. So Flash Gordon was this great IP that was sitting there for somebody. And my memory of it was the movie was like really horrific and unwatchable and became immediately like made fun of.
That was my memory too. Like I didn't think anyone thought it was good, but like all terrible sci-fi, it does have its cult of people. I mean, that's science fiction does have a tendency to do that, to sort of like attract a kind of, I guess I watched this documentary on the NFL Network on the mathematical formula for putting together the schedule.
Yeah.
And it's a half hour show. And the weirdest thing about it is there's like 8 minutes where they just really describe the software used to do it. Like it's all done on computers, but I don't know how I ended up watching that.
Was it good? Or it was just you couldn't believe somebody made this?
Well, I saw it was on, so I just started watching it. Okay. At first, I was sort of like, well, you know, I didn't realize that it would have so much emphasis on the fact that, like, they have to figure out, like, which games will be televised and, like, what will be the national game and that the NFL, like, I kind of assumed the networks did that. But it's really, you know, and they have, like all year to work on this. But the guys act like they're just like the clock is ticking and we must present Roger Goodell with the best possible schedule. And like they get it in at the last minute, like under the deadline, like they try to add this drama to it.
Great. I would definitely watch this. And then you watched the 1971 music one. That was the other one.
I started watching the stuff about the music from 1971. I just started, but I can tell they did a good job on it. Like this is, you know, I think there was some feeling initially. It's like, well, how thin are they going to slice these things now? It's like a documentary series about the music of one specific year. But the way that they're kind of unspooling it, it's like this is going to be a lot of great footage. I mean, there was already like in the first half hour, there was footage of like John Lennon working up a demo for the song he uses to attack Paul McCartney. But you can see him sort of joking around while he's doing it, which obviously makes the song seem much less mean. But I can tell I'm going to like it. What have you been watching besides The Mayor of
You know what's a good thing to just monitor? I think you and I flip channels. I don't know if anyone under 30 even does, but Access, that channel Access.
Yep, I watch that. I watch that quite a bit.
They have a lot of music documentaries, and there's a sweet spot. I can't remember. We might have talked about this. If we talked about this, I just have podcast memory loss. But I like when bands produce documentaries about themselves. It's like a guilty pleasure when it's like clearly tilted in ways to reflect positively on the band or twisting certain ways. And there's one on the Doobie Brothers that I watch every time it's on. I can't get enough of, because it's made by people who are convinced that the Tommy Johnston era was like the peak of the band. And they really resent that when Michael McDonald came on, the band took off and became really successful. But to the diehard Doobies fan, this is actually a bad time. This fame, wealth, Grammys, fortune is actually like a dark time. And it just sucked that Tommy, and then Tommy Johnston comes back, and it's like, that's when they did some of their best work. There's this guy in the documentary who's like a Doobies aficionado, who's kind of like the Stephen A. Smith of it. And he's just anti the McDonald era in a way that's hilarious, but it's actually a decent doc. But I like watching when these conceits are so clearly, they're trying to make some point that's just nonsensical, or they're trying to ignore. I just like watching bands revise their own histories with documentaries. I think is fascinating.
I think you would, there's one on Chicago. Have you seen that one?
100%.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's a good example of what you're talking about.
Oh yeah. And then there was in the credits, and it's all produced. It's all the people who are in Chicago.
Well, I mean, I'll admit I knew nothing about the history of Chicago. Like I almost everything I learned in that, I literally learned for the first time. When I was a kid, those were kind of like, those kind of documentaries were a big deal to me, because you'd buy them on like VHS, like Motley Crue Uncensored and Kiss Exposed. I mean, I would buy those things and watch them hundreds and hundreds of times. There are these stories that I still to this day, I can almost recite the things that he said. Like Nikki Sixx talks about getting his first guitar, and he has no money. So he goes into a record store with an empty guitar case, and he asks the guy for a job application. And when the guy goes back to get the application, he sticks the guitar in the case and walks out, then goes to the band. He's joining whatever band that was, and says, like, I'm here to play bass. And they're like, that's guitar. And he's like, but I'm here to play bass, but that's a guitar. Like, I remember this scene because I've seen it so many times that a lot of it's almost like, my understanding, talk about thinking you understand someone. It's like, if you watch someone tell the same story 200 times, you feel like you know what they're saying. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, there's going to probably be a lot more documentaries, I'm guessing. I wonder, like, you think they're shooting a Brooklyn Nets documentary right now about the quest for the title? There has to be, right?
Yeah. There's a book about the Nets, about sort of like that. I can't remember who wrote it. I think it's a guy for the Washington Post maybe or something, but it's pretty interesting. It's there could be a documentary about, I mean, there could be a documentary about everything now because of the amount of footage that exists. Like, did you see the Blind Melon documentary?
I knew they were making it, but I didn't ever end up seeing it.
The dude from Blind Melon had a camcorder and just recorded everything that he did for his life. So it's like it's not that you're learning anything just revelatory or anything, but you know, it's like he has the camcorder on, I think, like during the OJ Simpson car chase or whatever, like he's filming the TV. It's just everything he did. So it is pretty intimate, because it's like just it's everything in this guy's life. Like, it's easy to make an interesting documentary if you just felt, you know.
Like, well, the Billie Eilish thing was like that, right? They just had all these home movies of her for 6 years and carved it in. And, you know, it's definitely too long. But there's, I thought, a pretty compelling piece about just her relationship with her parents and her touring and, you know, while also trying to be a teenage girl. There was some parent stuff that I became I just thought was a missed opportunity, but at the same time, you can't really explore that stuff because you're doing it with the consent of the family. So how far can you go? But, you know, like she's like, all her body's all fucked up and they're still throwing her out there on these tours. And you're like, this is your daughter? Like your daughter's in pain? What are you doing? Wait, before we go, what are you working on these days? Just out of curiosity. Another book?
You know, well, here's the deal. I have a book coming out next year.
Okay.
Yeah. If it hadn't been for COVID, it probably would have come out this fall. But because of COVID, a lot of other book projects got pushed. And I think some books might be released a second time because they kind of got, you know, blown up when everything went down.
Well, so plus people couldn't do the book signing stuff and exactly. All the stuff you need to do to help push your book.
So it will actually be coming out in the beginning of February.
Do you have a title? Do you have a cover?
Yes.
What is it?
It's about the 90s. And it's called The 90s.
Really? Did you tell me you were doing this?
I told you and you were like, oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, I think I vaguely remember it. It's a great idea for a book. A lot of shit happened in the 90s.
Well, it's just, it's a little different than my other books in the sense that, like, I feel like some of the other books I've done, for the most part, they're kind of like a very specific idea that I had and that maybe only I had or whatever. But I mean, this is a book that's just kind of a straight telling about the culture and the politics and the science and sort of the texture of the 90s. I mean, obviously, like Halberstam did a book on the 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a book called The 60s by like Terry Anderson. There's a book on the 70s by a guy named Shulman. So it's like, I mean, it's called The 90s. It's one of those books. I pretty much wrote it during the pandemic. So we'll see what happens. Yeah. It's long.
I'm excited to read it. All right, Chuck. Who do you want to win the NBA title?
The Nuggets.
Jokic.
I've always kind of liked the Nuggets a little bit. Like even when I was a kid and I couldn't see them.
Yeah.
You know, I liked Alex English and I liked Fat Lever and I liked Kiki Vandeweghe and I liked Dan Issel. So I've always sort of followed. Like I kind of like the Broncos too. Like I have no relationship to the city of Denver, but except that I've always kind of unconsciously rooted for the teams there.
This is funny. This is how I feel about Seattle. You have these cities that there's no rational explanation why you kind of, I always just kind of like Seattle. So I feel that way, except when they played the Pats in the Super Bowl that time.
You know, I'm always surprised that for reasons I cannot explain, except maybe I kind of like their odd color scheme. I always find that I sort of root for the Tennessee Titans, and I don't know why that would be. Like, I really don't know. Like, why that? Like, I like the Oilers, but I did not make that mental relationship jump or whatever. But if I'm watching an NFL game where the Titans are playing, and I don't have any feeling about the other team, I seem to naturally gravitate toward rooting for the Titans. I don't know why.
Unconscious rooting. Hmm. Yeah. Mine is for the city of Seattle. I can't explain it. All right.
So you like this? Yeah. Okay.
It was great to see you.
Yes.
I'll see you. I'm sure I'll see you in LA at some point. Thanks for coming on though. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's it for the podcast. Thanks to Chuck. Don't forget about Book of Basketball 2.0 launching a new season around Len Bias. It's called What If, the Len Bias Story. 7 episodes. Really hope you enjoy those. And Raiders of the Lost Ark on the Rewatchables. That's up this week as well. I will see you on Thursday.